Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a Kickstarter Wednesday episode, and today we're going to be talking about a campaign that just got started. It's got me really excited. It's by a hopefully new and upcoming creator. So I have the writer, Trevor Fernandez-Lenkowitz, joining me. Some of you may know him as Dark Knight Nation from his YouTube channel, and he's guested on here before to talk about comics. But he's putting his money where his mouth is, and we're here to talk about his first project. So, Trevor, thanks for joining me.
Hey, man. Thanks for having me on. It's weird to be on the Comic Source Podcast under a totally different light. So,
yeah.
I appreciate you having me on and giving me the opportunity to talk about this book. I definitely put a lot of myself into it, and I pride myself with the collaborators that I surrounded myself with for this project. So, you know, I couldn't be more happy to be here.
Yeah, like you said, it's so interesting because we've been on each other's, shows so many times, but this is such a different aspect of coming on. So the first thing I like to do when I have a creator come on is kind of get their secret origin. So I think you've mentioned this to me before, but I don't remember or we didn't go that in depth. What is your secret origin with comics, man? Like, how did you discover comics? How did they become a passion for you?
I grew up watching reruns of the Batman animated series and then like Batman Beyond. And really when it came down to comics, it was probably like early high school. And I was hanging out at a friend's house, and he kind of lives out in the middle of nowhere comparable to where I'm living at. And he ran out of power went out, and he had some of his dad's comics, some of his comics, and we were just kind of reading by essentially flashlight. And I had gotten into, you know, some Batman stuff and your much maligned Grant Morrison Batman, which is the pretty much impetus behind me getting into comics. And I had very much not followed up on that for a while. And I don't know what it was. I think I had seen the Dark Knight movie, the Christopher Nolan Dark Knight film. And I was like, man, I really need to get into this Batman stuff. So I remembered the name Grant Morrison, and I started looking up his Batman run. And from then on, I started reading his run. Obviously was kind of confused at first. And, you know, to, I think, your disbelief from our many shows, it actually made me more interested to go and learn and find out what I'm confused about. And that kind of led me into picking up Scott Snyder's New 52 Batman as my first monthly book. And here we are, man, a couple years later. I am absolutely in love with the medium of comics, and I've written my own, which is really crazy.
Yeah, and for those that aren't familiar, haven't had a chance to go to a Kickstarter and check out Area 51, the Helix Project, why don't you tell us kind of what the story is about? What's the elevator pitch? What sure, draws people in?
So let me just preface this by saying I've had a horrible time trying to come up with something to give publicly before this book comes out, because I am so very much an opponent of the way comic book publishers, namely the big two, market their books by just giving away everything that's good and not really giving you anything to be surprised about. So let me do my best to kind of stoke the flames of interest while also keeping the things that are important for you to read and to feel exclusive to the story. So basically, this story deals with something called the Helix Project, which in this world is a government secret ops sort of experiment using foreign extraterrestrial DNA, skin grafting, genetic editing to splice their DNA into soldiers as this new sort of super soldier program, which is not an unfamiliar thing in comics. I guess the idea of the super soldier program, but what's cool about this is that these extraterrestrial creatures are able to use various sensory cells in their body to replicate the sort of genetic structure of something that they come into contact with. So they can shapeshift in a way, but they can also strictly manipulate very specific parts of their biology on a molecular level. And so not only does this help in a sort of physical combat manner for the military, but it also provides outlets for espionage and reconnaissance. So there are so many different applications. And this story, the main thrust of it takes place in the 70s. And, you know, the United States is really in full swing with the Cold War, of which would end up lasting, what, about 45 years, I believe. Feel free to correct me if I'm wrong. Of you know, our U.S. history. And so, you know, it's like, what happens when this becomes an actual viable thing and an actual viable method to ending the Cold War? And, you know, what sacrifices have to be made, right? Because things like that never come without a cost. And this story really follows somebody who is sort of... he's dealt a blow by something like that, you know? So it, as much as this story is very much a sci-fi noir kind of following this extraterrestrial life and how it's being sort of manipulated and, you know, for figure of speech, sort of molested by the United States government. You know, we look at who's really suffering because of this. It becomes this very, very personal story. And I'm doing my best because I really don't want to give away a heck of a lot. But really, you know, this story to me is very, very personal. I think that genre fiction is the most effective way to reflect aspects of the real world, aspects of things that we all sort of deal with in a much more impactful way, right? In a much more almost exaggerated way. And that's kind of what we set out to do. You know, we're kind of challenging conceptions of society, mental health, identity, memory, and things of that nature. So I want to use all of these cool tools within the science fiction genre and within the medium of comic books in particular to tell a crazy story that is also very personal and something that I think a lot of people will be able to access on an emotional level.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. So I know but about this a little bit, but a lot of our listeners won't. You know, because it sounds like a lot of what you're talking about here when you talk about the abilities of you know, this DNA and, you know, by grafting it onto humans, what it can do. And there's a renaissance right now going on with hard science. So when you talk about, you know, telling science fiction stories that have, you know, roots in reality. And so it kind of dovetails with my next question of did you always want to be a writer? Cause I know you, when you first went to school, you had a different background and that kind of feeds into pulling from, you know, real actual science to tell the story, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. So I started at the University of Connecticut or UConn as a molecular and cellular biology major, of which I was doing fine in, but I was miserable, frankly, and I never really gave myself the credit of being good at the more sort of creative outlets. I always figured they were just easy things to do. And, you know, early on in my college career, I had kind of met a couple folks who are brilliant, but not... able to access and output much in the way of sort of creative energy. And I realized, you know, maybe it was just something I was decent at. And eventually, for whatever reason, I felt like adding my voice to the internet and I started doing comic book YouTube. And I started, I started leaning more towards analyzing stories and being critical and taking a very sort of narrative approach to making reviews. And it was kind of natural in a way, and it sort of continued to build, and I would continue to sort of interview professionals in the field and those of which that would give me advice. And I realized, you know, this is something I want to do. I feel like I have a good enough eye for these types of things, and the collaboration in particular between the writer and the artist and the colorist and all these sort of different moving parts in comics, enough to make a story that I think matters, right? And a story that will not only entertain, because that's highly important, but connect with people, something that people are going to remember and sort of feel on a very personal level. You know, I spent some time over the last year or two really honing the craft and becoming a better writer before I decided that I wanted to go public, because I think, you know, with all due respect, I think a lot of people put out like their first works and you can tell that they were just overly excited to get a product out there with their name on it. And that's not something I'm interested in doing. And I've said this to you and I've said it to our frequent collaborator, Comic Boom, in the past. I'm not interested in making a decent first comic or a good first comic or a great first comic. I want to make a damn good comic book. And I don't want anybody to look at this thing and think, wow, you know, this guy's first outing is solid. I just want this to be looked at as a solid comic book. And obviously there are things that I'm going to have to grow from, and I'm going to become a better writer. Frankly, I'm in the middle of writing issue 2, and I already kind of looking back on what I've done on issue one, I think I've improved already. And I very much look forward to people engaging in the story and maybe, you know, even figuring out where I can grow as a storyteller, right? Because as critical and as analytical as I think I can be about story, obviously it's going to be different when people who are not me are looking at my work. So yeah, that's kind of like the general gist of it. I kind of approach writing in a way with an almost scientific kind of analytical brain, which is I think what really brings my contribution to, you know, the overall space of creative storytelling. And I think that's what makes it unique.
When you decided to make that change, you decided, okay, you know, maybe I am going to pursue something that's more creative rather than, you know, this the original major of, you know, science and biology and such. Did you have a lot of creative ideas at that time already of stories you thought you might want to tell? Were there seeds of that already? And what made you decide that this of if you did have multiple ideas, that this was the first seed that you wanted to grow?
Oh, no, absolutely not. That was actually one of the things that I think scared me the most, was that I realized, or at the time when I decided to make that decision, I was very self-conscious of the fact that I felt like I didn't have an idea that hadn't already been spun. And generally, you know, as a kid and as a young adult, I wasn't super exposed to a lot. So half the time I come up with things and then I'll you know, bring it to, you know, one of my closest friends who is a movie buff. And he was like, oh, that like this. And I'm like what? You know, I think it's this cool and original idea. So I always kind of run stuff past people before I put some real time into it. But even then, you know, I'll always try to put a spin on things. And I think the more that I've written and the more that I've read, the easier it becomes for me to come up with ideas, you know? But yeah, this certainly wasn't something that was spawned back then. I think, I don't remember what it was. I think it was after I decided to make the switch or right before, and I was reading an article and my sort of specialization when I was studying molecular biology was molecular genetics. And I don't know exactly what it was. It was probably a combination of, I hate the fact that DC Comics hasn't put out a Martian Manhunter book that was decent in a very long time. And then I had a background in biology and I started thinking about, you know, various receptor proteins, how, you know, the cell sort of goes through replication and identifying sort of different signals throughout. And I think to myself, like, you know, why hasn't anybody done kind of a hard science fiction comic book like this, you know, that has to deal with stuff like that? And I think there are a lot of sort of very hot button topics and issues that are super relevant that I think could be approached using that very sci-fi oriented toolbox. And I also have been highly inspired over the last couple of years by what Ed Brubaker's been doing with his independent work, a lot of these sort of crime thrillers, crime noir books. And I think to myself, you know, why can't I sort of merge the two and go for a very sort of hard cross-genre book that focuses on, you know, what I can use from those two separate toolboxes to tell this story, this narrative, and get these themes across the best, right? Because to me, I think the best stories are awesome, often vessels to say or to do something or to talk about something, to get a conversation started. And that's kind of one of the things that I aim to do. But along the way, I've also realized again that entertainment is a huge part of that process. You have to give people things to get hooked into, things to get them excited, interested, scared, just kind of feeling all and evoking all of these different reactions. And so I've really tried to culminate all of these different aspects and mechanisms to telling narrative stories, and I've tried to put them into this book.
Yeah, so you come up with the idea, you're pulling inspiration from, you know, things like Brubaker's recent work. Obviously, your science background gives you a leg up when it comes to that aspect of the story. And technically, you're going to tell the best story you can. But why the 70s? Like, where did that come in? Was that part of the crime noir? Was it just wanting to set it in that paranoid time of the Cold War? Was it a combination of things?
Yeah, it was certainly a combination of the two, right? I mean, so the supposed or all of the news around the Roswell sighting was in the 50s. And it was really 15 to 20 years later when the flames were really stoked in the American consciousness, and the hysteria of UFOs really became a huge sort of component of everyday life and of pop culture. And aside from the fact that I think the 70s and all of the sort of social tumult provides a very interesting environment to tell the story that I want to tell. So it is very much a component of both. You know, it was a hysteric time, both I think in terms of where the United States society was and where we were sort of consciously, you know, whether or not people believed or did not believe in all of this sort of UFO hysteria that was going on.
Now, you know, this is your first project, and we know there may be others out there listening who are kind of in the same boat. We have a pretty good audience for Kickstarter Tuesdays with people who are just getting started. So at what point when you were working on this project, you have the idea, you're writing it, and you think, okay, I'm ready to move forward. I'm ready to start looking for an artist. Tell us about that process and who you're ultimately settled on.
Sure. Yeah. So for me, a majority of my favorite comic book writers were very much full script, were very high detailed in what they were looking for, and in a way almost directorial. And before I had found my artist, I really took it upon myself to do a lot of reading in terms of how to formulate a screenplay. I had also read a book on actual filmmaking in terms of directing and cinematography, so that I could sort of fine-tune what I want my vision to be. And then at that point, it became, you know, going down to finding an artist who can not only interpret that script and tell a very successful sequential narrative. That I think is important to talk about, because a lot of people, especially early creators, I've found in just, you know, providing analysis on the YouTube channel, they'll find artists that can do beautiful pinups, but have no idea as to how to carry a sequential narrative, because it's very important, right? It comes down to a number of different things, from the composition of each panel, the layout, the shot angle, what's on camera, what's off camera, gesturing, character acting. There's so much that comes down to that. And it's not always who draws the prettiest picture. And then, you know, there is obviously the element of how is this artist going to render this world, texture it, light it, things of that nature, which are ultimately kind of represented in that more sort of a understanding of how aesthetically pleasing a still image is. So it's coming down to an artist that can satisfy both the need, again, for something that is aesthetically pleasing, but is successfully a visually narrative piece of art. And, you know, I've talked about it with you before in private, and a lot of my favorite artists come from like Brazil and Spain and very much that area of the world, and are not found yet. That area, hope I'm not like spilling my freaking secrets for my future projects, but there are a lot of guys and gals out that way that are so artistically strong and are not appreciated in the way they should be. And you even see that in professional comics. You know, you guys got guys like Eddie Barrows, who did a beautiful job with a couple arcs of James Tynan's Detective Run, with Freedom Fighters, with Robert Venditti, and a number of other projects. Got guys like Robson Rocha, who's had an extended stay with Kelly Sue DeConnick's Aquaman and a couple of other things. They are brilliant artists, both in how they, you know, do their pinups and achieve aesthetic pleasure, right, for the reader, but also in how they tell a story and how narrative they are. So frankly, I looked that way, and I found my artist. His name is Marcelo Salazar. He's worked with the likes of Justin Gray and Jimmy Palmiotti, of both of which I know you, Jace, are very much a fan of and friends with. And I wanted to find somebody who would bring that real professional caliber of work. And you know, for anyone out there, if this is any advice from somebody who is kind of going through it, make sure that the artist that you choose can interpret your script the way you want them to interpret it, or even bring something to it that you never could have imagined. And that was very much the case. You know, I'm an okay pinup artist, but I could never do the sequential narrative of a comic and do it to the degree that I'd like to, you know, kind of put out there in a comic. And so I looked for somebody and, you know, I'd give him a couple pages of my script, see if he read it well, get a couple layouts, make sure he's sort of following along with what I'm putting down. Because again, I mean, I'm not Alan Moore. I'm not writing a page of script per one panel, but I do very much have an idea of what I want things to look like in my head. And, you know, in many ways, Marcelo was brilliantly able to do what I needed him to do and do all the things that I didn't know I needed him to do. And that's kind of where we settled. He had a style that I think very much appealed to the sensibilities that I think this story was also going to appeal to. And frankly, he's just a great guy to work with. I found somebody who is able to well communicate and sort of take revisions very well, and it's a good working relationship. Aside from the fact that, again, I think he's a brilliant artist, and I think that his work just deserves more spotlight. And I'm happy to be a writer with the potential to do that.
How did you know when it was time to start looking? Did you have like the entire script all laid out, like revision, and ready to go, or were you, you know, a little more rough and let me start looking because I may tweak my script a little bit based on the strength of the artist?
Very much the latter. And I think also, you know, when I had first written the script, I was an okay writer. But because I had gotten busy, it's honestly, you know, like everything had kind of started about a year ago. And, you know, I work full time. I'm a college student. And to varying degrees of success, I try to put up content on YouTube. And so it keeps me very, very busy. But this past year has also provided me the opportunity to become, I think, a significantly better writer, a significantly more aware writer. And so I had almost completely overhauled that first script. Thankfully, Marcelo was still free to do the project, but you know, we had sort of built that relationship and discussed things. And I still had the same general idea for the direction of this story, right? Because it's a 6-issue series. So I obviously needed to have at least an idea of where I wanted things to go. But I think the way in which I can sort of deliver that narrative and that story has significantly improved. And so really, to be frank, I had started looking, I think, way before I was even ready. And over time, I was just fortunate enough that Marcelo still had availability by the time that I think I became a capable enough writer to tell the story I want to tell.
So did you have him on board and started receiving finished art back and then start looking for a colorist? Or, because I know that was a challenge for you as well.
Oh yeah. I mean, I went through so many colorist applications and it took a long time. It took a very long time in comparison. So I had finished art pages. And I was looking at some colorists, you know, throughout the internet and such. And, you know, there are a great many of them that, one, don't respond well to the prompt that is put out there into the internet and don't exactly give you what you're looking for. You know, if I can give any advice to somebody who is looking to do this, always when you get samples from a colorist, always ask them for the art before they colored it, because any stage in the artistic process of a comic can totally make or break the visual aesthetic and, again, the sequential narrative and tone in a very high number of the sort of storytelling mechanics that need to be in cohesion with one another. And so I would have artists who improved the work of the pencils and inks that were under them. I saw colorists throughout the process that frankly did not do a service at all to the pencils and inks under them. And really, you know, depending on your pencil or an inker, they can be one that very much evokes different elements of lighting and shading and things of that nature. But you know, your colorist is almost entirely your cinematographer, and they're going to be dealing a lot with atmosphere and tone, and I needed somebody with a lot of consciousness to that. And fortunately, after going through multiple handfuls of colorist applications, I found somebody who actually was affiliated in some ways to my artist Marcelo, and you know, we happened to be able to settle on something that worked well for us in terms of a working relationship. He did a good job sort of evoking and putting on the page what I felt needed to be on the page. And in many ways, you know, going beyond that, you know, that cover image that, if for those of you that haven't seen it, I recommend you go check it out, whether or not you buy my book or not. Just go to Kickstarter and type in Kickstarter, The Helix Project on Google or whatever, and it'll pop up. There's something really brilliant about the way Marcio, my colorist, is able to set up the sort of brilliance of space and how he's able to blend it and mix it and texturize it. And then if you go on into the sample page, the way he's able to really set up the mood, right? And the sort of perspective of the protagonist at the time. Everything is very deliberate. And because I take that very deliberate approach, I needed somebody who was able to follow through on that. And again, this is my first experience crafting a comic. So I needed somebody who was also good enough to maybe do things in ways that Marcelo was with his visual storytelling, was able to do things that I didn't quite know I needed. And that's very much the case here that I found. And I will say this cover, although seemingly simple, is very sort of thematically resonant with a big part of this book. And it's specifically laid down in the way that it's colored. So coloring, for those of you that might not have an overwhelming appreciation for that aspect of the comic book making process, the coloring has a huge impact on the way that the story is received.
Yeah, I think color work, color artists in general are vastly underappreciated. You compared it to a cinematographer. I always think, I can see that comparison. I always think of them as kind of the composer of the piece, because I think soundtrack and, you know, live action, film, television, that it's, you know, it so much sets the mood and the tone and expectations. You know, when you hear that music start to build, color's the same way in a comic. It can really affect the emotions you're feeling. You can, you know, ratchet up to a high impact point. You can, you know, be brought down from a real strong story beat. And that's all done almost on a subconscious level by the color. So mm-hmm. I think they're underappreciated, as are letters a lot of times. And you went with a very established letter artist in Taylor Esposito. Was he somebody you had in mind right from the start?
100%. Yeah. You know, the one thing I've constantly heard from comic book pros that I've interviewed and talked to even off camera is that a lot of major publishers and editors from said publishers really look at the quality of the lettering, because it shows a high attention to detail, because it is often the thing that people both read in comics and even sort of getting into the early stages of making comics might think are not significant, right? Not important enough to pour the money into or the effort into. And it is. It helps to curate the experience. It's very specific. And it's something that I think is very much a blind art, in the way that you were kind of discussing music composition. You know, I think that oftentimes the best composers are able to create a piece that curates the experience that the director wants to tell. And it shouldn't be something that totally sticks out to you. It should just be a sort of another part on the vehicle that makes it run smoother. And that's very much, you know, what I was looking to do. And Taylor Esposito and his Ghost Glyph Studios, man, they're doing some of the best lettering work in comics. And I was so fortunate with how reasonable Taylor was and how accepting he was of my pitch and how I just very much appreciate that somebody of his talent, somebody of his reputation, was so open and understanding to somebody who has never done this before. It's just so far, it's been really great communicating with him. And I'm really, really fortunate that Taylor has the time to be a part of this project.
Yeah, that's really cool. Taylor's a really good guy. Well, let's get back to the story just for a second. Much like yourself, I want people to pick it up. I want them to experience it. So we don't want to spoil. But is there anything more you can tell us about the main characters, like who they are, or what we can kind of expect? I imagine you, like a lot of writers, are planning on taking us on a journey with these characters. They're going to grow and they're going to change throughout the course of the story. So what can you tell us without giving too much away?
Yeah, so absolutely. So our protagonist's name is Kent Armstrong, and it is a reference to Superman. This book actually has countless sort of homages and sort of plays thematically on the idea of Superman. Actually, for those of you who that haven't gotten to take a look at the Kickstarter, the fully colored sample page actually has very specific reference to Superman that I think is very obvious. And, a big part of the story is identity. And Kent, being the son of the extraterrestrial that crash landed during the massive Roswell sighting back in the 50s, has a hard time really struggling to deal with concepts of identity, especially when, he is half human, half extraterrestrial, and somebody who can, again, change his form between the two at will. And it becomes this sort of idea. And one of the themes or questions that we sort of work with is, what happens when the hero of the story doesn't look like you? Right? Superman, it kind of begs the question of, was Superman's sort of reception in the public eye high because he sort of looked like really the people who were in power, right? In society, and when Kent sort of natively does not look like that and has to consciously make the decision to not look like that, what does that say about the world that we live in? And why does he feel that way, right? Like, what about this world has made this kid with practically unparalleled potential feel the need to shelter and hide a very, very important part of himself? And I think a lot of people can connect with that. You know what I mean? I think, there's always that part of us that I think is extraordinary, but for many reasons, we might feel the need to keep that away from the surface, right? It might be the way society looks at those things at the time. A lot of it can be very time specific. It can be very sort of geographically specific. And one of the things, again, that we kind of approach are, what happens when a person with such great potential feels the need to shelter their potential because of the way the world will look at you and who you might sort of manifest on the outside, and especially compared to how that person might act, right? There are so many sort of philosophical and profound sayings about it's not, what you are on the inside, it's what you are on the outside. It's not what you say, it's what you do. And I think oftentimes the world that we live in, even now, define you by what you say and what you look like rather than what you do and what you sort of actualize through those, through sort of manifesting those things, I would say. So, Kent has a lot of things to struggle with. And like I've said here, and I say it in the Kickstarter campaign, one of the things we do tackle is mental health. I think it's a very important thing to look at. And it's very much been brought to the forefront of, world society at large. But you look at something like the 70s, where I think it's not so considered. We look at PTSD. We're obviously going to be talking about elements of, I would say, I'm trying to think of the best way to put this without A, being too revealing, and without B, being way too topical than I need to be. I would say with just the idea of being a person of moderate thinking rather than, thinking via extremism or being too weighted on one side or the other. As Kent also has to balance his identity or learn to balance his identity. He also has to learn to balance a number of other things about himself, whether it's sort of nature versus nurture, you know, or sort of how he puts the world into perspective. And a lot of the story is about perspective and about the way that we sort of take in all of the stimulus around us and how we choose to act on it, how we choose to intellectualize that, to validate the way we act on it, or even times the way we just sort of instinctually and non-intellectually react to those things. One thing that I wanted to do in this book, because most of the things that I've written involve kids with daddy issues, is give Kent a really strong sort of paternal figure to sort of found his moral basis from. And that's very much something that Kent has. You know, his father, who ends up taking the name Roswell after the location that he crashed in, is sort of the ideal dad. And he does a number of very valiant things in order to instill positive values and ethics into his son. And it begins to approach a number of the various sort of thematic questions that we're going to be answering throughout this book. And, you know, what happens when that moral foundation for Kent is taken away so abruptly. And I don't want to say how that happens and when that happens, but it is important to sort of realize what loss also does to us, right? It can totally change a person for good or for temporary, and for positive and for negative. So, you know, I'm as much as this book, I think, is a lot about balance and moderacy, we're also trying to balance the approach in perspective to each one of those issues and show all of these different topics from multiple angles, right? To make sure that we let people who are reading this book make their own decisions on how they feel about those sort of topical issues without sort of shoving it down their throats. Because I don't think that art is, as much as I think that art and storytelling can be a vessel to do or say something, I don't think it's my right or my obligation, for that matter, to make anybody feel the way I feel. I think it's just setting up a question for me to sort of develop and let the reader or whoever is absorbing this art start to consider and hopefully answer for themselves.
Cool. It sounds, yeah, I mean, I can't wait to get my hands on it and check it out. It's I mean, I think identity is such an interesting thing, because no matter what, no matter which side you're on, red, blue, no matter how old you are, you know, young, old, it's something we can all relate to. We all, you know, have a sense of self-identity, who we think we are. But one of the most interesting things about identity is we all have different identities to different people. You know, you're a son or a daughter, but you can be a husband or wife, boyfriend, girlfriend, father, mother, friend. You know, it's so interesting. We all have so many different identities, and the way that we identify ourselves and see ourselves can change over time. So it's a really interesting concept to explore.
And on that, you know, I think a lot of people either subconsciously or consciously, I think it'll definitely change on a person-to-person basis, but how we choose to sort of self-define is also affiliated with our thoughts and our beliefs. And sometimes I think we might tie ourselves and shackle ourselves to those things too much, right? I mean, even I think simply getting into arguments about geek culture, sometimes we can get offended if somebody totally disagrees with you. And it's because we sort of assign ourselves to the things that we believe in many ways. And, you know, one of the things I wanted to approach, I guess, in making identity a huge sort of thematic component of this book, is that, you know, what happens to a character who is able to change and shapeshift himself at will and chooses to condemn one part of himself and not the other? And why does that happen? Who's telling you that, you know, one part of yourself is unacceptable? And you know, we're looking at all these different ways for you to self-define in comparison to how other people define you. And I think it's kind of fascinating, especially in a world now where we're starting to see all of these different avenues aspects of sort of the way people identify themselves. And it can be approached from many different ways, you know, just who you are on a personal level, how you act. It could be a very specific biological personality, you know, how you identify yourself based on the way you look, the way you sound. You know, it's fascinating, and I think it's very multifaceted, and it's something that, you know, every other person that might be sort of toggling or tackling that theme can approach it in so many different ways. And I think that having this person that feels very mentally and emotionally and personally shackled when he's able to be whatever he wants to be is going to give me a lot of really interesting sort of real estate. That's the word I was looking for. It's going to give me a lot of real estate with the story to kind of explore those things. That's it.
Well, being that it's your first project and you're 65% funded as we record this, there's 27 days left. By the time this is released, there'll be about 25 days left. So you're still early stages. So you may not have a great answer for this question. This question may change by the time your first campaign is over. But what have you learned, or is there anything you've learned already so far since you've started this campaign? Or maybe even in the prep, the lead up to the campaign, anything that you learned that you wish you knew before you started?
Do more logistical planning way in advance. You know, the original goal was to launch September 1st. We ended up launching September 3rd because of, you know, not having, I think, the proper art to show. Because originally the art that was going to be promoted was, I think, a little bit too narratively revealing. And I'm not saying what I'm showing isn't narrative, because again, every page, every panel to me is very deliberate and is very much part of chaperoning this experience that I want to bring the reader along on. I very much wish I had sort of thought things through a little bit more when it came to that sort of end of the production. Otherwise, you know, all I can say is that making a comic book has so many different working parts. So it really does take a lot of logistical planning, both in terms of scheduling and operating in that way, but obviously also financially, right? Making sure you're budgeting properly. You know, one thing I'm really, really proud of is that I think in the various rewards that I have on the Kickstarter campaign for backing the project, I think that I've put a lot of sort of self-awareness in there. I know I'm not a big name. I know a majority of the people that are going to be reading this book have never read anything I've written prior or don't know me at all. And I want to make sure that I'm providing a quality product as much as I think that I am providing a high quality story and a high quality experience. And I want to make sure that people are getting their money's worth, because I think one of the biggest issues that I have with Big Two Comics in particular, but I think comics in general, is that they've become ridiculously expensive. Especially for the amount of time that you spend with them. So I really want to make sure that people not only walk away feeling satisfied after reading the story and experiencing what I'm hoping that they'll experience. I want them to feel like it's money well spent and it's a product that's going to hold up. And it's something you and I talked about behind closed doors. You know, you had mentioned that many Kickstarter comics are super expensive. And my first response was, I get that, but I'm not a big name that can just kind of inflate the price of a book because I have a name, nor do I really want to get to a point where I do that. I am very much aware that the standard cost of a cheap floppy comic, number one, is at least $5. And it's usually 20 pages of story, even though they solicit 24. And my plan was to, you know, if I'm going to charge the same price as the professionals, as the big boys, we're going to make it worth every ounce of the readers and the customers' money. So we're doing 24 pages of actual story. The stock that both the cover and the interior are printed on are very high quality, actually significantly higher quality than Marvel and DC right now. For those of you that know the paperweights, the cover as of right now is going to be printed on like the 105 pound stock, and the interiors, I believe, are going to be printed on 75 pound stock. And the average, for example, DC comic book, the ratio is about 85 cover to about 55 interior, and Marvel even less. And again, you're getting 20 pages of stories in those versus 24 pages of actual story. So this story won't have any ads, nothing like that. I want to curate an artistic and narrative experience for the reader. And, in any way that I can avoid sort of having to compromise that because of financial deficiencies, I would like to very much avoid.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring that up, because I know even on even other Kickstarters, you know, they usually charge a little more. And I totally get where you're coming from in terms of, you know, you don't feel that you're established. You know, who are you to expect people to pay even more for your book? I think, you know, a lot of times it comes down to the fact that, you know, you've got to be able to actually produce the book, and, you know, you don't have a big corporation, you know, behind you with all the machinery in place. So oftentimes a lower print run is going to cost more than, you know, higher print run and things like that. So I think it's great that you did manage to keep the costs low. And hopefully, you know, this gets fully funded and you make a little money on it, because, you know, it would be nice to be able to pay yourself. But also, I know you want to start socking cash away for the next issue, you know, so there's that as well. So why don't you let everybody know what some of the tiers are. Like, you know, you mentioned you can get a copy of the actual book, physical copy, 24 pages, and it's basically the same cost of a Marvel comic.
Oh, yeah. So one really cool thing that is going to be 100% a Kickstarter exclusive is that every single issue of this book comes signed, unless you would like to request it not be signed, in which case I'm happy to oblige. Less work for my hand, I suppose. But every single physical copy of this book will be signed. So not only, you know, for the basic $5 pledge, you're getting a signed copy of the book with the 24 pages of story and the premium quality printing material. For as low as $4, you can just get a digital copy. You know, I get it. You don't know me. I don't know you. You don't know my sensibilities. You might not trust me yet. So, you know, it's $4 is an easy way to get yourself in from the ground level. And hopefully we will build a writer to reader relationship where you do trust me in the future. And you'll go up on into getting variant covers, of which the variant cover art will be released within the next week, which I'm super, super excited about. That is one of the things where I'd admittedly, maybe not failed logistically, but I was supposed to have the first variant cover done by a known artist who had to back out at the last minute, which is unfortunate. So maybe that was partly my fault for not making sure that I had enough sort of headway before launching the campaign, but here we are. And you know, you can, and I will be skipping things, because if I go through all these, it's going to take forever. You know, you can go on into tiers where you'll get both the physical variant cover, anything, I think after the, anything $7 or more, not only would you get a physical copy regardless, but you'll also get a digital copy. And the digital copies from that point on will all be sent out before the book is even printed. So you'll get early access to this book, which I'm super, super excited about getting eyes on it and getting a feel for what everybody is thinking about the story. But you know, you can go on into getting artist prints, which are going to be chosen and voted on by the backers. Obviously it's your money, and I want to make sure that people are getting things that they feel is worth said money and their time. So the artist print will be determined, I think, probably in the next week or two, for those of you that have already backed, as sort of an incentive and as a thank you for those of you that have believed in the project early on. You know, we'll get into custom made t-shirts that won't be released after this. You can get, if you're a retailer out there, we do have a retailer package with a little bit of a discount. You know, we get into really, really big things where I'll give away copies of the script, signed and not. I'll give away, or not even give away, you can earn yourself a producer credit on this book, which I think is kind of a cool experience, to say that, you know, you not only were on the ground level of this book, but you were a producer or an executive producer, all the way up to getting drawn into this book. Your likeness can either be drawn in as a background character or an actual recurring supporting character, which is, I think, is a really fun part of the comic book experience. You know what I mean? How great would it be to be a lifelong comic book fan, or even a new comic book fan, and to say, oh, that's me that appears in multiple issues of this comic book series. So I think that, you know, the rewards tiers sort of appeal a little bit to everybody, and into a bunch of different sensibilities. And again, I'm doing my best to try to make sure that it's worth the money and the consideration that people put into it. That's very, very important to me. And if it means anything, this base goal, like that I've set, I make absolutely no money. I can promise you that this $5,000 base goal is basically just to reimburse what I've already spent on art and to go towards printing, shipping, and a number and the production of the merchandise and things like that. I do not plan to make money on this book because I feel much more comfortable earning the trust of my readers and my audience through the quality of the work before I make any money off of this. This is a labor of love. And with that being said, if we go beyond that base goal, we're going to have stretch goals where everybody who's contributed to at least the physical product itself is going to be getting free upgrades that will cost them nothing more. And once we hit 75%, I'll be revealing those in the updates of the campaign. But I'll say this now, specifically for the Comic Source listeners, is that if we get to my end goal, which is doubling the base goal, which again is called a stretch goal for a reason, and it's called my end goal for a reason, is that we're actually going to make this cover, this book a hardcover first issue. And if we do get to that point, I will never reproduce a hardcover version of this first issue ever after this. I will be offering a second printing of issue one when we get into hopefully the second Kickstarter, not trying to get too far ahead of myself. And if I am lucky enough to do that, and if we do hit that hardcover edition stretch goal, I will not produce a hardcover copy of issue one after that. So things of that nature, all of this money is going to get put into making sure that this is the best quality product it can possibly be. And if I do end up making any money off of this, it's going to be going directly into the production of issue two, because I want to make sure that I can be as consistent as I possibly can. It's one thing that I was feared about doing a Kickstarter, because it obviously takes time to get the funding. So with that being said, I'm doing my best to make sure that as soon as I possibly can, I can get the next Kickstarter out for issue two, so that the people that read and enjoy issue one can get their hands on the next installment. I'm very much a proponent of being conscious of how these stories are being digested. And it's one of the biggest problems that I have with comic book publishing. And I promise if I could, I would just deliver a full graphic novel at once. But unfortunately, it's not necessarily financially in the cards. So I'm doing the best I can to mitigate that.
Yeah. And as I said, as of this recording, it's 65% funded after about 4 days. So hopefully keep on the same pace and should reach that end goal. So Trevor, I really appreciate the time. Thanks for joining me and telling everybody about your Kickstarter and your project. Is there anything else as we're closing up here that you want people to know?
Honestly, I for those of you that are listening, I want to say thank you for giving this the time of day. Obviously, thank you, Jace, man, for giving me the opportunity to get on here and sort of stumble through talking about this book, because it's so hard for me to not only discuss something that I'm making, but also to do it in a way that doesn't deprive those who want to go back and read it later and experience it for what it is. So, you know, it's kind of this is definitely going to be an experience of growth for me, but, you know, I really, really hope you guys go check this campaign out. Even, and I understand times are tough, but if this at all has interested you, this conversation, please, feel free to share the Kickstarter link with your friends, anybody that might be interested. That is an absolutely huge help. And if you check out, you know, my YouTube channel, there will be a couple of opportunities for those of you that might not be able to financially contribute to maybe get a copy of the book for yourself. And you'll obviously also see Jace there. We've collaborated, I think, more and more frequently as time goes on. So I don't see that coming to a stop anytime soon. Really, I just want to say thanks for giving me the time of day. Thank you for listening. And I really hope that you take a look at this project, because it's something I really believe in. And it's something that I took a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to make.
Yeah. And Trevor, why don't you let everybody know where they can find you on YouTube, social media, and that sort of thing?
Sure. Yeah. So I have a Twitter account, which I use for the YouTube channel, but also as of right now to promote the book. It is at Dark Knight, like the Shield and Sword Knight, NAT25, Instagram Dark Knight Nation, or on YouTube Dark Knight Nation. Most importantly, you can check out the Kickstarter simply by going to your internet search engine and typing in The Helix Project Kickstarter, or Kickstarter The Helix Project, whichever you fancy most, and giving it a look. We'll have some promo art up there with those aforementioned sort of references to our everybody's favorite Man of Steel. I hope that what we've provided there is enough to convince you of how much effort we put into this book, and how much quality I think my collaborative partners have been able to bring to this book. So at the end of the day, I want to say thank you in advance for checking it out, whether you can or cannot or choose not to contribute to the campaign. I appreciate the time of day.
All right, everybody, and I'll put links to the Kickstarter and all of Trevor's social media in the show notes as well, so you can go click there and find it. So again, Trevor, best of luck. I can't wait to get my hands on it and read it myself. I'll be following along and keeping our listeners up to date. Hopefully it gets fully funded.
Thanks, man. I deeply appreciate that. Thank you for having me on. It means a lot.
All right, everybody. We want to thank you all for listening as always, and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.